Testing. Oh, that's plenty loud. Thanks. So, everybody, I'm going to introduce Dr. Carlos Brown, who's the speaker this afternoon. As the sign says there, it's a presentation called MASH Notes, and it's about a surgeon's video blog from Iraq, Dr. Brown's video blog from Iraq. Dr. Brown is the director of trauma at Brackenridge Hospital just down the road. He went to college here, was educated at UT and UTMB Medical School, and spent 7 months of last year in Iraq, in Ramadi, where he was the trauma surgeon. And he's going to be sharing his experience with you there and kind of how web technologies and stuff like that played a role in his experience there. He's also my brother, so it's a great pleasure for me to welcome him here, and I'm very proud to be able to introduce him. So with that, I don't think I've ever called you Dr. Brown before, but Dr. Brown.
It's about time. Thanks, Glenn, and good afternoon, everybody. I want to thank Glenn and South by Southwest for allowing me this opportunity. And like he said, we'll talk about my video blog from Iraq. So like Glenn was telling you, I'm now the trauma director at Brackenridge, but it's been a fairly recent change for me. I just moved back here in the fall, having grown up in Austin and been gone for basically the last 18 years. Last 5 years, I spent as a trauma surgeon at LA County, Los Angeles County Hospital, University of Southern California, one of the busier trauma centers in the world, practicing trauma surgery. In addition to that, I was active duty in the United States Navy for the last 14 years, the last five of which I spent as a Navy surgeon, but also at LA County USC. And my job in the Navy was to train troops going to Iraq and Afghanistan in trauma. We don't really have a lot of military trauma centers, so my job was to train them, get them up to speed in trauma basics before they go over to Iraq or Afghanistan at the Navy Trauma Training Center. And then August of 06, it was my turn to go overseas and do my 7 months in Iraq. And that was really a difficult time for me, mostly because I had to leave my family. My wife and my three kids lived with me in Los Angeles, and obviously can't take them to a war zone with you, so it was time to leave my kids. And here you see me on the parking lot at Camp Pendleton, California, getting ready to load the bus on the way to Iraq. And that, you know, communication was going to be key for me during this time. And I'd been deployed before, but only when I was married or engaged, not ever with kids. And I was really having a struggle figuring out how I was going to deal with this. And like I just saw my brother there. He works for Google and YouTube, and he told me to set up a blog. And I have to tell you that I really didn't know what the word meant at all. He said, "You need to set up a blog." I said, "I have no idea how to do that." So he kind of took the lead, and he bought my family a computer with a camera, and he kind of set the whole blog up for me. And here you see the face page for that blog, Trapperlos MD, which is the name he came up with. And kind of what I want to share with you today is my experience with this blog. And I'm not going to tell anybody in this room how to set up a blog or the technology of a blog, because I don't really know much about it. What I really want to do is show you how this blog changed my life and changed my 7 months in Iraq. Allowed me to do a few things. Allowed me to communicate with my family in a very high-tech way. And on a daily basis, it kind of forced me to really document my seven-month experience over there. I think without the blog, I wouldn't have been as aggressive in pursuing pictures and video clips of my time over there. And this allowed me to collect this information and put it in a blog format. Again, I'm not here to discuss the politics of the war or anything like that. It's just kind of a personal journey of my seven-month time over there and how the internet and this blog changed my time. A little bit about where I was. You hear a lot of news about Baghdad. I was actually in Ramadi, which is about 60 miles west of Baghdad, capital of the Al-Anbar province. About 500,000 people, mostly Sunni Muslims, so not as much intertribal battle as in other places in the country. A little about the levels of care, so you kind of know where I was. Military levels of care, level one is kind of the Marine or his buddy taking care of each other, or a corpsman or an aid station. They practice tactical care. Their priority is not taking care of the injured casualty. It's not getting killed in the midst of the battle. I was at a level two facility, which has resuscitation capabilities. They can give fluid, they can give blood, surgery, maybe able to hold the patients for a period of time. It kind of depends on where you are. As you'll see later, my facility didn't really have the ability to hold patients at all. And I don't know if you've heard in the news, the FRSS or the FRIS, which is the Forward Resuscitative Surgical System, which is what I was stationed with, the Marine Corps unit. Level three of the hospitals you hear about on the news in Baghdad and Balad, they have basically every subspecialist you could imagine. They have CAT scan, MRI, full blood bank that you would need here in a stateside hospital. Level four is Landstuhl, Germany. All our troops go from Iraq or Afghanistan through Germany before they come home to level five facilities such as Walter Reed, Bethesda, and Brooke Army Medical Center. where they get their definitive care and their long-term rehab. So this is my level two facility, obviously not a not what you see here in the States, not a typical hospital back home. This is the front view of my medical center here. And this is kind of one of my, some of my earlier blogs, and really I was using a lot of pictures here. I can just show back home immediately as soon as I arrive what's going on, where I'm at, and my wife and my kids and my friends can kind of get a taste for what we're doing. You don't really get this view on the news or in the newspapers. That's the front of my aid station. This is the back of my aid station here. You see here on, where patients get pulled up on this side, and I lived right across the street over here to the right of this facility. But this is the where the ambulances pull up or the tanks pull up with the casualties. Here I'll give you a little tour of our trauma room. Here you see, this was posted on a blog as well. You see me walking in the trauma room where the casualties come in. And this looks fairly simple. It doesn't look like you could do much, but it actually has all the equipment you'd want to need to take care of a trauma patient. Here we put our sickest patient in the first bed and then the less sick in the second and third beds. And we have things like to control their breathing and give them fluid and blood and put IVs in. And if these three beds aren't enough, you'll see there's overflow into the other side of this room where you can put patients 4, 5, 6, and 7 in case we get numerous casualties, which, as I'll show you, is kind of one of the biggest differences of being over there is the numbers of casualties that show up versus a civilian setting. And kind of a very rudimentary diagnostic capabilities. Basically, we had a simple x-ray, a simple ultrasound machine, and some simple lab tests. No CAT scan, no fancy equipment, no real ability to do any advanced imaging or diagnostic tests. This is our operating room. This, as simple as this looks, it was truly that simple. The anesthesia machine was really old. Our anesthesiologist for a while didn't really know how much anesthesia he was providing. He just knew he was providing either enough or too much. But it was hard to monitor these patients, and you can kind of see how basic this was. This is our intensive care unit. So if you've been in an intensive care unit, you know this is not a place you want to stay very long here with basically no capability to take care of you postoperatively. So we basically took our casualties immediately from the operating theater onto a helicopter and out to a higher level facility because spending any time here if you're sick was a dangerous endeavor. This is my team. These are the eight guys or the other, seven other guys I spent time over with there. I'm on the far right of the screen there. To the left of me is Commander Clark. He's an orthopedic surgeon. And then next to him is Dr. Junker. He's an anesthesiologist. These two guys I still keep in touch with quite regularly right here. The next ones are my two operative techs, one of my corpsmen, Petty Officer Ruggiero, who actually was in his second tour, previously receiving a Purple Heart, as you'll see in a little bit. And then down below on their knees is my physician assistant and my flight nurse. And these guys, I dedicated a blog to each one of these individuals. Once, I think their families can see them in a little bit more personal way than they can in letters or pictures. And then also for me to have as a memory repository of them and how my time was like with them. And I'll give you a little outtake of a few of their blogs that that I put together here.
I love playing Madden.
You like playing video games?
It's just a video game.
Yeah!
It's just a video game. Just a video game.
I was with my squad who were clearing houses, and we ran into an ambush. There was about 10 insurgents inside the house, and opened fire when we were knocking on the door, banging, trying to get inside the house. One of the really good friends, Eric Hodges, was killed, and one of the other Marines was shot in the knee. And myself. I was awarded a Purple Heart by President Bush.
My friend Dave Junker, right here. Thank you. He's a man.
Woo! So I kind of used these blogs as a tribute to each one of my teammates and talked about their family and their background and what they did while we were in Ramadi as well. And I look forward to looking at those 10, 15 years from now. One of the big differences, here you see a picture of downtown Austin in my hospital Brackenridge circled in red there. And basically, if you get injured anywhere in 11-county area around Austin, you're coming to Brackenridge Hospital, where you like it or not. And, you know, we take care of you. I take care if you show up there like I would my wife or my kids or my family member the best that I can. But there's not very often emotion involved in it when you're taking care of patients at Brackenridge. You just do the best you can and you know, take care of the problems that you're faced with. But when you get over into a combat zone as a military surgeon, there's a tremendous amount of emotion associated with taking care of somebody who, number one, is wearing the same exact uniform you're wearing, like these Marines or soldiers you're taking care of, And number two, in Ramadi, which was in the middle of the city, my medical base, they're literally a couple hundred yards outside the fence getting shot at defending me inside the fence. And so really it was an incredible amount of emotion, which I wasn't used to at all. I wasn't used to having every day taking care of casualties and getting choked up and trying to, you know, maintain focus while taking care of them. And a little different, too, within a civilian side. Here at Brackenridge Hospital, you know, you have a crash on I-35 or you happen to get shot on the east side or something bad happens, you roll into Brackenridge in an ambulance. In Ramadi, you're out there doing whatever you're doing in an outpost or you're in a firefight and you get shot and you get brought in by whatever vehicle happens to be nearby at the time, like this. And that video clip made it onto one of my blogs, and it really dropped some amazing comments from people that were watching, because it's not something you get to see every day. And even for me as a trauma surgeon, when I take care of these patients all the time, this was completely different than anything I'd experienced before. Just that, again, the emotion of taking care of these guys, plus the rush of adrenaline of huge tracked armored vehicles pulling up and dropping them off. And then it comes back to, you know, we're over there without families. None of us have families over there, but these guys become each other's family. The guy on the right is a first sergeant with the Marine Battalion. He came in with every single injured Marine he had under his care. And you see below the Marine on the gurney there is his uniform that we cut off. Again, we're cutting off the same exact uniform we're wearing. And you have to kind of keep that all in check while you're trying to provide care to these young American troops. We also took care of some other folks, obviously the Iraqi police in the top left. You know, my parents always said, if you see a masked man with a gun pointing at you, it's bad. But these guys were supposed to be on our side here. But it was always kind of nerve-wracking when they'd pull around the corner in a white Ford with these machine guns pointing everywhere. Then the Iraqi army. We didn't have much Iraqi army. The Iraqi army is almost all Shia. We were in a Sunni area, so there wasn't much army presence there. We had civilians and, unfortunately, some kids that were injured a fair amount there. These are some of the kids we took care of. The girl in the top left, I actually did a blog post just to her because it was, you know, it was a girl who was playing in her front yard and got shot during a firefight. And that sort of horrible stuff we saw all the time. She came to our aid station. We stabilized her, sent her to the neurosurgeon in Balad. And then she ended up coming back through Ramadi with her dad here going home. And, you know, I entitled that blog, you know, Silver Lining. It was actually, I felt like we did something good. You know, it was unfortunate she got shot, but we were able to save her and send her back to her family. And she was completely back to normal. So, kind of a different view of what we're doing over there. In addition, we took care of some atypical patients. Here you see this military working dog and his handler. You see they were both actually patients of ours, and you see the dog always outranks the handler in the Marine Corps, so that way the handler can't mistreat him, I guess. But these guys showed up together one day. They were both fine. And when they come in bunches. You know, at Brackenridge, I may admit 10, 15 in a busy night, 20 patients in a 24-hour period. Usually they come one at a time, two at a time. Really busy, you might get three or four. We always knew when there was a big group of casualties coming because you felt an explosion outside of base, much larger than what you're used to. You're used to having incoming rounds, outgoing artillery. But these improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, that really did some damage, you'd feel them from, you know, a mile or less than a mile away, and it would rock your house and everything. And so you'd feel this explosion, you'd walk outside, you'd look for the smoke, and this is what we usually saw. So this is a fresh IED had just gone off just outside of base. And so as soon as we felt that explosion, saw that smoke, we knew it was time to kind of start getting ready. And you see here, just to give you an idea of the damage, this is what also what I learned when I was putting my blog together is, you know, I had my own camera, my own video camera, but I started relying on other people. And this is from some of the warfighters that were out in town, some of the special forces guys that took pictures, you know, at the combat site. And this was a bomb this was an Iraqi policeman colonel's house that was hit by a car bomb. You can see there's tremendous damage that these explosions cause. And so, you know, this was one of the mass casualties that we had. And you hear the explosion, you see the smoke, you know it's coming, and you try to prepare. You try to get all your gurneys together, your equipment, your people, all the medical personnel from the base come. I was the only surgeon, but we had other doctors, nurses, and corpsmen and medics that were available. They'd all come to the site. And you try to get ready, and you line up everybody here. You get your litter bearers, your stretcher bearers ready to move the casualties over. You get your interpreters in case you get Iraqi patients. And no matter how much you prepare, you're never as ready as you think you are. And here you see the chaos that breaks out. This is when we got 50 patients in a matter of 15 minutes. And again, no matter how much you prepare, you can't prepare for this. And there's no way to get your system in order to take care of this. You just kind of do the best you can. But what I was there to do was provide trauma surgery support to the unit I was attached to. I'll talk to you a little bit about that. And it's kind of those things were the same at home. Here you see us scrubbing at the scrub sink, getting ready for a case, kind of like we would do here a little bit. You know, I don't usually operate in shorts at Brackenridge, but and then you see us getting prepped here for a patient. We're prepping and draping the patient. Some of the equipment is fairly similar. You know, you get into the blue gown and the blue drapes, you kind of start feeling like you're home. And then the basic principles of doing the operations are the same as well. Here you see us performing abdominal surgery on a patient that came in my first week that I was there. So now, I kind of want to pause here quickly. So this is one of the first wounds I saw, and this is kind of a wound we see here in the United States. You know, a car accident, someone messes up his arm. And I want to preface this by saying some of this, so the next few slides are fairly graphic. However, I took out the most graphic stuff. I don't know how many medical people are in the audience, but it can be pretty gory. And the other thing is, I had a hard time deciding what I could and couldn't put in the blogs. I put blog posts together that would have, you know, I would never identify people, wouldn't identify faces, but I would have blog posts that would have wounds and operations and things. And the basic rule that I had was if I felt like my kids could see it, then I felt like I could post it on my blog. And this is a common practice here in the States. As a surgeon, we collect pictures of our patients. It's under the informed consent when they come in the hospital. We're allowed to take pictures as long as they're not identifying. We take pictures of wounds and operations and things to kind of, you know, educational purposes for students and residents and also a chronology of what we've done. So here, this is the first wound I saw, and I was moderately impressed with this wound, but not so much. And then I saw my first patient who was hit by an improvised explosive device, and this was a whole different story. Here you see the damage that's done from these kinds of injuries. And the reason I show you this is two things. I think this, again, the emotion of taking care of our troops was one, but just the tremendous damage that these war wounds cause. I use the blog as a release to kind of get through this difficult kind of day-to-day activity. So here you see a Marine who had an improvised explosive injury to his legs, and you see us again cutting his boots off. So back to I'm cutting off the same uniform that I'm wearing here, getting ready to perform an operation on him. This is a mortar round to a leg, and again tremendous damage. And one of the interesting things about this picture, I think, if you notice, he's got a tourniquet on his leg right here, and you know, we're practicing medicine in an austere environment, not like here in the States. And these tourniquets were life-saving. We don't really use tourniquets in civilian trauma care very often. But, you know, we learn a lot from the military in World War II, Vietnam, you know, Korea, and so on. And I think we're going to learn a lot from this conflict as well. But you see here, again, the wounds and the damage that's done. And then even in the operation, again, even more damaged tissue than you would expect.
Shit get blown by
the amount of, you know, in the States, we take out bullets, knife wounds or whatever. Here you see the giant piece of metal taken out of this guy's leg. There's just not debris like this in the United States. We don't have explosions, but you see this piece of metal that went through this young Marine's leg, and I had to get used to this, seeing this every day. And again, I don't think I would have collected this video footage and pictures had my brother not set me up to put the blog together, because I would have never had the foresight to say, let me bring my camera and video and just take pictures and video of everything. And I'm thankful now because I have this database of pictures and video that I'll have, you know, hopefully forever. A lot of this, a lot of washing out of the wounds. Obviously, this is, you know, just a basically like a powered water irrigation device. And the IEDs were a problem, and so were the snipers. And the snipers were pretty good. And I don't say Iraqi snipers. I say snipers in Iraq, because a lot of the snipers were imported from other countries. But they were pretty good shots. But one of the most amazing cases I saw was actually a guy who did fine. You see this Marine got hit in his body armor. We wear body armor on the front, on the back, on the sides, on the groin, and the throat. And he got hit by a high-powered rifle right on the body armor here. And he went home with nothing but a bruise on his chest. And clearly, this is probably one of the biggest advances we had in this conflict was the body armor that the troops were wearing every day. But back to the IEDs. Again, this was something that I had, just seeing these wounds, I had no idea. You know, I taught classes to military people all the time, and I had no idea it would be this barbaric, the amount of damage that was done. And honestly, we were kind of doing barbaric surgery in a barbaric way, because here you see it's a handsaw to do amputations. In the hospital here, we use a power saw. It's much faster. It's much easier. But we didn't have power equipment. Remember, I was at a surgical unit that was so far forward that we just didn't have the day-to-day conventional equipment that we would have in the hospital. So you see most of our amputations, or all of them, actually done with a handsaw. And my orthopedic surgeon, who saw playing video games, was kind of a pretty boy, and he hated the fact that we didn't have power. So you get to watch him put in an orthopedic screw by hand, which was always part of my favorite part of the operation, watching him having to do this by hand. So again, no power to drill these in. And then also, splitting someone has an open heart surgery, you split their chest, their breastbone with the power saw, and here you actually do it with a hammer and chisel, because we didn't have power, but still had to get access to that part of the body. You see us operating here. This is something unusual here, and I wanted to give people some operative footage on the blog because I think it's important. But you see us here doing two operations at once. I'm working on the leg with an assistant, and the orthopedic surgeon is working on the arm. And this is not a common thing in the States either. I mean, at least in my practice, usually one surgeon takes care of one part of the body at a time. And then also doing more than one case at a time. You're trying to finish up one case while the other one's rolling in the room here. You see the volume at times was overwhelming. So you kind of do the best you can with what you're given. And the other thing that I was impressed with was operating in front of people. When you're in the hospital here at BRAC, I operate in front of my partner, the room nurses, the anesthesiologist, and maybe some students. And in combat, you have the entire, that member's unit sitting there watching you. And, you know, that's just kind of we had an open door policy. If they wanted to come in and watch us take care of that Marine or that soldier, we allowed that. And you kind of, I don't say puts pressure on you, but you kind of want to be there to take care of the best that you can and show them that you're doing everything you can for their wounded friend. But it also had us an easy access to a blood bank. And when you talk about here in the United States, hospitals essentially have an unlimited supply of blood. Now, you still need to get blood drives and stuff, but you have blood and you have plasma and you have platelets. And over in Iraq, we didn't have that. We had a walking blood bank. And this was kind of, again, I'm using a high-tech, blog to communicate with my family, but we don't have simple things like blood and plasma. What we did have was a walking blood bank, which was one of the more amazing things I saw while I was over there. You're in the operating room, you're doing a difficult operation, your patient needs blood, you don't want to exhaust your local supply, so you overhead, you say, hey, we need 40 people to donate O-positive blood or A-negative blood. And as a rule, they'd show up by the dozens. You see they hear soldiers and Marines lining up to donate blood. This was one of the more incredible things I saw. I was in the operating room most of the time. One time I actually came out and got to watch this happen. And they would show up by the dozens, and they had no idea if this blood was going to an American or to an Iraqi or to an insurgent. They just knew that somebody needed blood. They'd line up and donate, as much as you needed, essentially. You had unlimited blood at that point. It literally pumped from their veins directly into the bag. You see this soldier here pumping the blood out of his vein right into the bag there. So a pretty incredible way to take care of these folks. Now, once the blood was done, the operation was done, it was time to get cleaned up and move along. And the one thing that was different, too, we had no cleanup crew in the hospital. We had just our operating room, and then we turned the room over. So it's not all the time that Brackman's, I end up mopping the floors here. But, the operative team was the same as the cleanup team. We end up taking everything ourselves and cleaning everything up and getting ready for the next case. And then it was time to transport the patient, the casualty here. And this is, again, kind of new and old coming together. You wouldn't normally take a civilian trauma patient and put him in the back of a helicopter for a one-hour flight with the doors open. That's not an ideal situation. But in combat, that's kind of the access you have to that care. You have a helicopter that's coming to pick him up. It's about an hour to Balad, an hour to Baghdad, and there's often no temperature control in the back of the helicopter. So what you see here is the breathing machine here at the foot of the bed right here. The monitor to watch how the patient's doing, and this is the patient's head right up here. And what you see is he is sitting in is a body bag. And this really took, this developed in OIF 1 and 2, is that the best way to keep these guys warm is put them inside this body bag wrapped in blankets and foil and stuff like that. And it took a while for the other Marines and soldiers to realize that this was okay, this guy wasn't dead. It was just a way for us to keep him warm in transport to the next level of care. Now, the same way that those tracked vehicles came up to the back of our hospital, and now you see the ambulance is pulling up to take the patient to the helipad. And in my situation, the helipad was only a couple hundred yards away. And the difficult thing was, at night, we had complete air superiority, but during the daytime, our helicopters were at quite a bit of risk of getting shot at, and essentially got shot at with every transport. So, and if we didn't have to transport during the day, we didn't, but I wasn't going to put someone, a patient, at risk that we couldn't take care of there. So we ended up having to fly during the day a fair amount. We put the call in, the helicopter would come from Takadam. Turn that volume up. And then you're going to load. We load our casualties up. You can go as many four at a time in the back of the military ambulance. Then time to make the ride from the hospital to the helipad. And then unload the patient here. Really very well choreographed. They can't be on the ground very long. You can't waste a lot of time. They run out of fuel. They got to get moving. And there's usually a gunship circling to protect them. So every second counts here. We put the patient casually on the back of the helicopter. And my flight nurse would go with every one of these casualties, probably the most dangerous job, but I actually gave my video camera on a couple occasions to take some footage, which ended up being part one of the more impressive parts of the blog. He's leaving here now on this helicopter, and I gave him this camera to take with him, and the footage you'll see here to follow is his view of aerial view of Baghdad coming back, and I'm amazed at how much it looks like a city here in the States. You wouldn't think it's a war-torn country. So this is an aerial view of my nurse took of Baghdad flying back after dropping off a casualty. Not too different than back home. But I show this video clip again because this is probably my favorite part of any day that I was in Iraq, because I saw a helicopter leaving with a casualty that I had taken care of. And that was kind of felt like was my job, was I took every one of these videos myself and watching the helicopter leave the helipad over that building, because then I'd realize I'd done what I was supposed to do, which was get that casualty out of my surgical center to the next level of care alive. You know, I didn't have any control what happened after that, but I felt like I'd done my job if I could see that helicopter leaving. And it was easily the greatest professional privilege of my life, taking care of these wounded Marines and soldiers for 7 months over there. But it was also some of the most gut-wrenching time I had spent as a physician. This is the one American that I saw that died, came into my aid station alive and died while he was there. And this was excruciating. Again, it comes back to the emotion of taking care of somebody. I don't know him, but he's wearing my uniform. I know his unit. I know the other Marines in his unit. And these are all the young Americans that died just in the 7 months I was there, just on my base. Most of these I met in the morgue, but I went to the church and I took a picture of each one of these guys that the chaplain had a picture of them, and I kept it in my blog. I didn't post any of this on the blog, but I have it from my own records just to remember their faces and kind of who they were and attach a name to a memory. And so I felt like if I could have sent one of these guys home alive, I had done my whole 7 months was worth leaving my family. So this is how you feel. This is a picture that was taken by a freelance photographer I'll tell you about in a minute. But this is how you feel. You feel alone. You feel empty. You feel helpless. I don't really know what to do when these young Americans die that I'm supposed to be in charge of taking care of. And I want to spend the last bit of this talk kind of describing to you how we coped with it as a team and how I coped with it as a person and how critical maintaining this video blog on a daily basis with my family, how critical that was to basically my sanity while I was over there. A lot of it was the team. These are the five officers that I was stationed with, and I spent basically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with these guys. We ate together, slept together, worked out together. Everything was together the whole time. You really didn't have any separate time. And I still keep in touch with the orthopedic surgeon and the anesthesiologist and the nurse on a regular basis, and I expect these guys will be lifelong friends. But the bonds you develop, again, are kind of what help you get through this time. Did some of the usual stuff, received mail. If you know anybody over there, please send them a package. Doesn't matter what you send them, a pair of socks. It's fun just to open a piece of mail that has nothing in it. It's just fun to open mail. usual reading, you know, professional reading, watched the Longhorns collapse that year that I was there in the fall of 06. And I read Flags of Our Fathers, which was unusual to me because it's a World War II book, and some of the things we were doing in this conflict were exactly the same as the World War II conflicts. And I was always impressed by that. Some of the medical care we're providing at the front line, some has changed significantly, but others is basically, you know, hold pressure on the bleeding and don't get shot. Believe it or not, I had a Netflix account, and Netflix arrived directly to my base in Ramadi. So I was able to catch up on Arrested Development, The Office, and every single episode of The Sopranos. And then, like any good military facility, they pour a ton of money into working out. And so, being the scrawny guy that I am, I tried to work out and try to impress my wife when I got home and wasn't that successful. But spent a lot of time at the gym, and, you know, it burns an hour or two in a day. But the bulk of my time, I would say, was devoted to my blog and you know, the telephone center here, and you see our internet cafe. And I don't know of a lot of internet cafes here where the computers are covered in sand. But they tried to keep it as clean as they would, but when they would sweep, the whole room would fill with dust and you couldn't see anything. So we preferred to let the sand stay on the computers. So I'd put the blogs together on this laptop right here. I'd take it on a thumb drive over to the internet cafe and I'd upload it to YouTube, my videos, or to my blog directly if it was pictures or text. So I spent a lot of time here at the internet cafe, which is just across the street. And probably the most ridiculous one we had was a mustache contest. And believe it or not, this gained by far the most comments of any other blog that I posted. Most blogs got 8 or 10 comments. This got 80. And everyone from all these people's families voted on the mustaches and who they liked. And believe it or not, I'm number 2, but number 4 won, which is I thought was kind of the most pitiful one of all, but he won. We had some celebrity visitors, the Cleveland Cavalier cheerleaders. They were very overrated. Chuck Norris was by far the most popular visitor. The Marines love that guy. He's like a god over there. This was my favorite, was Jim McMahon. He's a Chicago Bears Super Bowl championship quarterback. My wife's family is from Chicago, so I posted a blog talking to McMahon for about 10, 15 minutes. And, you know, I'm sure these guys get paid to go over there, but just the fact that they're willing to risk their lives to come hang out with the troops for a while, I was always very impressed by that. And so did a Jim McMahon blog. This is Lucian Reed on the left of the screen here. He's a freelance photographer. I don't know if anyone's familiar with his work. He's from Austin and spent 6 weeks with us in Ramadi. And my documentation of my experience there would be nothing without his pictures that he gave me out of the goodness of his heart. He basically was there for 6 weeks, did a Newsweek piece, which was very controversial on our unit, just a photo essay. And he's been there essentially off and on for the last 5 years and has taken some of the more famous pictures you'll see from this conflict. This one right here is one of the more famous ones. Took pictures at Haditha, obviously a high-charge topic. But this guy, Lucian, is just a fantastic guy and was good enough to come over there to take thousands of pictures and share those with us as the surgical team. And just a super guy to be with. This is the all-time worst-selling cover in Texas Monthly history. And my buddy John Spong wrote an article about being over in Iraq with me and happened to be on the worst-selling cover in Texas Monthly history. But I grew up with John since the seventh grade, and he's a writer for Texas Monthly, and he saw my blog and saw the first few posts, and he called me about a month into my deployment, said, I have to come over there with you. So sure enough, in January, right before I came home in March, he came out there and spent 2 weeks with me, and then I brought him a story, not so much about me in Iraq, but kind of our friendship, what's going on in Iraq, the experiences he had. And he got an amazing snapshot. A two-week snapshot that he was there was very representative of the entire time of the deployment. We were very busy at some points, very slow at others, saw Americans, civilians, saw the whole kind of the mix of everything that we did. And it was kind of surreal having my best friend, you know, in the middle of a war zone for 2 weeks. A lot of my blogs were designed to basically talk to my kids and let them know that I was okay. Just kind of real simple stuff.
Honey, I love you. Thanks for taking care of the kids, the family, the house while I'm gone. You're doing a great job. I really appreciate all the love and support from home, and I can't wait to see you guys in the spring. I'm doing well. I love you, and I miss y'all. Bye.
After that, I got to the point where I have no creative abilities whatsoever. But after you take so many pictures and videos and you start posting blogs, you kind of get used to it. And I started to put some of my pictures and videos to music. And then, you know, sort of give a little bit of a creative side of, and give people a picture of what we were doing over there. Most of the stuff you'll see in this next clip, you've already seen in this talk, but you're gonna see it all put together here.
The heart is is a blue. Shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck. And the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck. And you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place. Someone you can lend a hand.
So you see they're kind of trying to give people a view of what we do in a little bit more exciting way. You know, birthdays were hard. I mean, I missed a lot of birthdays while I was over there, and that was one of the hardest parts. And, you know, this is my birthday cake on the top left there, my team made for me with the Longhorns. I went to Texas, like Glenn said. And I think just for my kids to see the fact that I had a birthday cake. I'm really far away. They haven't seen me in months, but I had a birthday cake, and that kind of made things better. There you see a picture of my daughter. I talked to her on the morning of her sixth birthday. I talked to her. My wife took a picture of her talking to me and posted it an hour later. So I got to see a picture of my daughter opening her presents while she's talking to me. And my mom celebrated her 75th birthday with my wife and kids. And John Spong was in Iraq at the time. And he and I, we couldn't be there for my mom's birthday, but we decided we'd try to participate somehow. So the second silliest blog we put together here.
Feliz cumpleaños, down by a soul. Feliz cumpleaños to you.
Happy birthday, Mom. I love you.
I love you.
So again, I think the kids like that when you see you're participating in the important days for them anyway. This is a picture from the Marine Corps birthday. I celebrated the 231st Marine Corps birthday while I was over there, November 10th. And the only reason I show this is not to see the mustache again, but to see I'm holding one of the two beers that we had my 7 months there. The Marine Corps put down an order saying we could have two beers. So this is probably the single two best beers I ever had in my entire life. So that's one of the Heinekens right there. Of course, not drinking American beer, German beer, but. Here you see Halloween. My kids, obviously Star Wars fans here, dressed up, and I got to see these pictures of them trick-or-treating. But I figured, you know, I knew they were going to wear Star Wars costumes, so I figured I'd return the favor and let them watch a blog with my costume. Kids, it's Dad. Happy Halloween. I hope you guys had fun trick-or-treating, and I want to see lots of pictures. We'll talk to y'all soon. Bye-bye. And then Thanksgiving, you know, we had we did have a turkey dinner in the chow hall. It wasn't like home cooking, but had a turkey dinner nonetheless. And then, you know, my family got together. Like I told you, my brother bought them a computer with a video camera, and they got to put together videos for me, which was the highlight of my day. And here's the video they put together for Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving!
Hi, Carlos.
Happy Thanksgiving, Daddy.
Hey, Los.
Happy Thanksgiving, Dad.
Happy Thanksgiving, son.
We missed you at the dinner table today.
I'm thankful for when you wrestle us and
for all the guidance all these years.
For you kiss me and hug me because I want you to do that all the time.
And then obviously one of the harder holidays was Christmas, but my wife was amazing and was able to get a still shot of the kids on Christmas morning. And I think that top left is my youngest son, Tyler, coming downstairs on Christmas morning. And I got to show them that Santa Claus made it to Ramadi as well. So again, you know, I think me seeing them and seeing their faces, but also them getting to see the dad was okay. And I had the, you know, the same traditions that we have at home. And then, You know, kind of what, more than anything else, I think with the thought of coming home was what kept me going the whole time. And I'm glad to say that almost a year ago to the day, March 19th of last year, I made it home. And with that, I'd like to close. Thank y'all, and I take any questions. Thank you. Thank you. I can't see you, but there's a microphone there. So if you just...
Great. First of all, thank you so much for your service to our country. Yeah, the military lately has had there's a lot of coverage, particularly in Wired magazine, about blocking YouTube and MySpace on bases, and now the Navy blocking blogspot.com blogs. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered, first of all, did the Department of Justice know you were blogging? And you know, specifically how you feel about that?
Well, first question is yes. And there are, I mean, you know, whether we like it or not, in the military, when you sign on the dotted line, you fall under a completely different set of rules and laws. I mean, you follow the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And they did know I was blogging. I had to clear it through my Marine Corps command. So my commanding officer, I told him I was blogging. He told the command I was blogging. They had oversight of, they didn't have access to my material, but they could have shut my blog down at any time. And when I was there, everything was active. MySpace, YouTube, Google Video at the time, all those sorts of things, chat rooms, and you'd come in the internet cafe and people would be chatting online all the time. And I know that as I was leaving, that was happening. How I feel about it, I'm a little bit mixed. I think this is such a critical part of my experience there, and I don't think I would have had as rich of a experience or a memory now after the fact, or the same communication with my family. So I feel strongly that we should have some access to communicate with our families in this manner. That being said, you're talking about 18, 19, 20-year-old kids that are using MySpace and things like YouTube, and not necessarily for the most appropriate reasons, not necessarily to communicate with their family, but to post things that are inappropriate, post gory pictures from the war, you know, post sensitive material from a security standpoint. So I think, do we need to have access to this? Or not we, I'm not in the military anymore, but do the troops? Absolutely. But there is a security standpoint that needs to be addressed at the same time. Now, complete shutting it down, that's a very typical response. I don't agree with that. Next question.
Yeah, also, thank you again. I served in Desert Storm and Desert Shield during the first go-around, and it was a lot different. So it's really amazing because we would wait for mail, and it would be months and months before we have contact. So it's really awesome to see that you guys are able to use that technology. My question is how was your access very limited in regards to the amount of access and time? It seems like you had pretty free access to upload and to do your stuff.
No, it really wasn't. It's funny you mentioned that. One of my partners, Dr. Eaker, is here in the crowd, another trauma surgeon. He was a Navy surgeon in Iraq during the invasion, and he had no access to any of this. It's really changed during the war. So, I mean, he basically had same thing, mail and satellite phones. So it's since we've become on static bases. I mean, I was on a static base with hard buildings and hard wiring. I think that's the invasion phase was different than it is now. But, yeah, it's great to have that. Access, I had, so my laptop was plugged into nothing. I just had my videos, my pictures on my laptop. In my room where I stayed, in my bedroom, which was a little one-room thing, I had internet access, but it was government internet. So I had no access to YouTube, Google, ESPN, anything like that. It was purely like CNN.com and my email. So you had to go to an internet cafe, which I showed you. The internet cafe was run by a civilian morale, welfare, recreation establishment, and they had more access to things like YouTube and MySpace and things like that. However, above them is still the government, still the military that can come down and say you do or don't have access. I was there, I guess, at a time where this wasn't so much on the front page of the papers. I think that it wasn't as big a problem. Now it may be worse. And in fact, I know some friends that came after me had a much harder time maintaining a blog than I did. I just consider myself lucky, I guess.
And a lot of the stuff you talked about was your family and friends sharing information, but a lot of the pictures you showed were about your military, your medical procedures and some of the things you faced that maybe you didn't face here in the States. Did any other surgeons or people at other bases who may be facing the same things also contact you through the blog, or did you share any information about actually how to do things and deal with some of these kind of practical operational challenges that way?
Not so much on the blog. Military surgery is a fairly small community, and we shared information all the time outside of this. So, I mean, that's more of on a professional level. We would share videos and pictures on a professional level. And, you know, I'm a trauma surgeon by trade, and so I felt comfortable doing trauma. That being said, there are plenty of plain general surgeons that are expected to do combat trauma, and we do a lot of training and sharing. I mean, I've shared this information countless times with these folks that are going over there. In fact, like I said before, my job in Los Angeles was to run the Navy Trauma Training Program. And so I spent a great deal of time sharing a lot of my pictures and videos after I got back and say, look, these are the injuries you're going to see. I can't describe them to you. I can't do them justice. But this is what you're going to see. This is going to have to deal with it. It's going to feel bad because you're not going to be able to do everything you think you should be able to do, but you do the best you can and you move on. So I think, yeah, the professional sharing side of it is critical in civilian and military trauma. Yes.
I think medical personnel do have a unique chance to show the human side of events like this. My sister, who's a pediatrician at Texas Children's Hospital, got a chance to go to Kashmir after the earthquakes. And she showed my family at Thanksgiving all of the photos that she'd taken there. And it was really, really very interesting. But since she's not into blogging, she didn't get to share this kind of experience. How have other physicians reacted to what you've done here, and have you sparked kind of interest in the medical profession of doing this sort of thing?
I mean, in my little limited circle people that have seen this talk, I've given this talk on grand rounds at universities or at conferences, and it's not this talk exactly, but a talk about my experience in Iraq and included some blog information. And I had at least half a dozen surgeons that were getting ready to go to Iraq ask me, how did you do this? I mean, how did you set it up? And As I'm probably still relatively naive about it, but not as much as when I started. And I was able to say, look, you know, you go to Blogger, you go to YouTube, you set up accounts with both, you upload it. And I sort of, at least the few people that I interacted with, I was able to say, this is how you can set this up. And I know of a few physicians that have done this, and not as many as I would have expected, actually, because this was such a critical part of my experience. I would have expected a much bigger reaction to it. But I think probably it just takes a lot of time. The time commitment to and the discipline to do it every single day and really maintain is hard. But yeah, I mean, I shared it and people seemed interested. As far as what's out there, I'm not really sure.
Have you continued to add on to this current blog, or you have started a new one?
I know. It's a point of friction with my wife, actually. But when I came home, the last picture you saw with the banner across the fence there was a whole bunch of pictures of me coming home, me coming off the bus, my house is decorated, neighbors coming out, our first meal at McDonald's, obviously you can expect that. But I didn't feel comfortable posting that. I felt like my experience was over. And I if you look at the website, the last blog is a kind of a 10-minute video of videos and pictures and kind of all from the beginning to the end. And I felt like I had closure to my experience, and it brought closure to me emotionally. And I felt like posting that other stuff was then just trying to more draw attention to myself than it was really what that blog was about, which was to communicate with my family. And I haven't really... I've sort of started a blog, just my family's blog, showing pictures of the kids from my mom and my wife's parents and stuff, but nothing continuation from this. I ended it when I left. Yes, sir. In October, so I was in Ramadi, Iraq, which is an army base, several thousand soldiers and Marines, and you know, when they first got there, they were on a little base and had to, you know, get control of the city. It was a pretty violent place back in 05, 06, 07. And in October of 2005, they sent a Navy surgical team to support this Army unit. Didn't have a surgeon because there was some activity going on there. And I was just a continuation of that Navy surgical team. And, you know, the war changes up and down. And when I was there, it was super busy. It's actually slowed down significantly now, so they probably don't need a surgeon. For the volume that I did, I was probably the right amount of surgery that you need there. It was about a one surgeon job because you had an orthopedic surgeon who assisted me, who was, you know, just as good as any other assistant you could have, and an anesthesiologist. And there weren't very many times where we couldn't run, you know, there weren't many times we had two or three cases, operative cases in a row that you had to do, or you couldn't get to one because you were doing another one. It was a pretty good mix of people and numbers that we needed, at that specific time anyway. Any other questions? Trapper Los MD. I didn't make the name up, my brother did. TrapperLosMD.blogspot.com. All Trapper Los MD, all one word. Anybody else? Yes.
If we wanted to send mail, you said they enjoy receiving mail. Who do you send it to? Who do you address it to?
You can find, we got a lot of mail from school kids, like any soldier. There's organizations all over the country that say you can send it to any soldier. If you can find someone that you know, even remote, you know, two or three times removed, a friend of a friend of a friend or whatever, you can find out what unit they're in, and that unit, the unit representation here in the States will have their address in Iraq. And honestly, it doesn't have to be anything. I didn't care what was in the box. As long as there's some, you get a piece of mail, it has my name on it, I get to open it, it's got, you know, a picture from a fourth grader in Wyoming or something, but it's something to open, it's something fun to do for that, you know, 15 seconds. So, but you can find addresses. If just find your, whatever your nearest military command is around, you know, here like Fort Hood has got a ton in San Antonio, you can find people that need mail. Yes, sir. I was a commander, which is like a lieutenant colonel in the Army, a commander in the Navy. Yes.
You said that blogging afterwards was a little problem with your wife. I wonder.
No, I don't want to.
Well, no.
She's in Los Angeles. She can't speak for herself.
But I wonder if your kids are interested in blogging as a result of this.
You know, my oldest is 9, almost 10, and he's definitely internet savvy and computer savvy, but I don't think he's quite grasped the blog concept yet. Probably not yet. I imagine it's coming. And it came to why I could do it in Iraq, because I had so much time and it allowed me to have the discipline to keep it up. Here, I come home and I don't feel like I have a free hour to download pictures and upload videos and do all that takes. You know, the editing of videos took me forever. Again, I'm pretty naive at it, but I don't think I have the time here to devote to really putting together a cool blog on a regular basis. If I had more time at work, maybe I'd do it, but my kids haven't showed interest as of yet. They love this stuff. They love the videos my brother did and stuff like that, but thanks. Yes.
So have any of your patients from Iraq tracked you down through your blog here in the States?
No, not one. One patient I did not show here who had probably the worst injury I saw while I was over there. A doctor that took care of him in Launchstuhl and a doctor that took care of him in the States contacted me. They saw me give this talk and they contacted me and said, I took care of this guy. I was in a unique situation. If you're in Baghdad or Balad or Launchstuhl, your patients are with you for much longer. My patients were never there really much more than, you know, half hour, an hour before surgery, and then after that, they're asleep the rest of the time. So I didn't really have the interaction with them, and I did no post-operative care whatsoever. And that's probably one thing that I miss, that I feel like I missed out on, was the development of a relationship, which I have with my patients here, was a chance to develop a post-operative relationship with the casualties I took care of there. So I really haven't had any communication since that time. Yes, sir. Yeah. No question. No question in my mind. Me, on two levels. Myself personally, I'm unquestioned with the fact that I'm a better surgeon having spent 7 months there, taking care of injuries that, just catastrophic injuries that what I would have one of my partners here helping me with, or two surgeons helping, you know, three anesthesiologists, unlimited blood supply, and doing those same catastrophic injuries in a very austere, difficult environment. And so there's no question I became faster and better while I was over there. In addition to that, I think the military, like the other conflicts that I mentioned before, what we learned from previous conflicts, we've learned about things here, you know, topical hemostatic agents to stop bleeding, factor 7, which I'm sure you've seen articles and controversy about factor 7. And so I think trauma surgery, because of this conflict, has gotten better as well. And we've been able to, and we almost always translate that to civilian care. But there's no question it's improved my abilities, I think, as a surgeon. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much.